I don't know how to describe God most of the time. For me, God has to be something that is really indescribable. God has to be somebody who cannot be conceived of in human terms, with human thought. Without a God who is too big to contain in your mind, I doubt that he would truly be able to fulfill all that he has promised to do. And I doubt that we would have the awe and respect for him that he deserves. But we always fall short, or at least I always fall short, when I think of God, when I try to describe God in my own mind or put characteristics to him. And so a lot of times I ask myself, how big is God? How large is God? How immense and eternal and infinite is God? And I can't answer that. I really can't. Mathematically, I can write you equations. I can perform operations that involve plus and minus infinity. I can divide zero into a number. I can do all sorts of things, but I can't conceive of what infinity really is. Just like I cannot understand what it is to be without time. And for me, it's important to have a picture of God in my mind, of somebody, of a being that is beyond my ability to describe or to understand. And one of the ways that I do that, one of the things that gives me a perspective, at least on that, is his creation, the universe. Unfortunately, I think for most people today, science is really struggling against certain beliefs that have diminished the reality of what the universe really is and how big it is and how special it is. You might even say that religious superstition and secular teaching have painted a picture of ordinariness for both man as well as this earth. I mean, this is a picture of nothing special. Man is nothing special. This earth is nothing special. And that really started about 4 centuries ago when mankind figured out that the earth was no longer the center of everything. It's not the center of the solar system. That was a big shock because their egos said, oh, man, God focuses so much on man, he must be the center of the solar system. Sun must move around it. Then we found out it's not even the center of the galaxy. In fact, it's pretty much in the middle of nowhere in this galaxy. And then he found out, worst yet, we're not even the center of the universe. So I think man's ego has let him down because he was disappointed in that this earth isn't as special as he thought it was. Well, in spite of the bleak picture that myth and superstition and not so much religion, believe it or not, but some sciences and a lot of religions that don't understand the Bible have painted, there is something special. There really is. And this universe is something to be awed by watching and observing and learning about. In fact, there's a principle called the Copernican principle. And it's got another name to it. It's called the principle of mediocrity. And that has really been the stance of science for hundreds of years. Josephus records something quite interesting. He says, Abram communicated to the Egyptians arithmetic and delivered to them the science of astronomy. For before Abram came into Egypt, they were unacquainted with those parts of learning. For that science came from the Chaldeans into Egypt, and from there to the Greeks also. You know, I think most people, when you look back on history, think of ancient peoples as being ignorant, and worse yet, even stupid about their world around them. That's not the case. Mankind is intelligent. Abraham was quite intelligent. He taught the Egyptians astronomy. That was a huge science. And without the tools of technology, he brought a huge amount of learning to the Egyptians. You know, most of us were taught that Europeans prior to Columbus believed the earth was flat. Well, I, up until about 3 months ago, had always believed that that was what a lot of the Europeans thought. And unfortunately, that is a myth. That is false. That was started by a guy by the name of, Washington Irving, who wrote a four-volume history of Columbus. And he got it from some mythology that some religious organizations had written in their attempts to describe the Bible. But this is a fairly recent, and I think he wrote in the 18th century. But it turns out that history not only shows that people knew the earth was round, but it was common teaching in educational institutions since Aristotle. And he lived 300 or 400 B.C. I'm going to read Isaiah 40:22 from the Douay Rheims, because it's the only one that has taken a more astronomical view of this particular verse. Still uses the same words, and they're accurate, but it is a more astronomical view of this verse. It says, "It is He, speaking of God, that sits upon the globe of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as locusts. He that stretched out the heavens as nothing and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in." Even the Bible was written in correct terms. You know that Aristophanes, back in 240 B.C., calculated the diameter of the earth, the radius or circumference of the earth, to within, depending upon the numbers you use, 2%, worst case, 20% of what it actually is. This was before there were satellites. This was before there were telescopes. This was before all of the technological things that we have today. That's an incredible calculation to me. He did it without a calculator, too. So advancements over the last century, especially the last 20 years, really have produced an enormity of and wealth of information about the universe and God's creation. And I wanted to take a look today at some of the things that have come out. And these are by scientists and astronomers who, in the end, some of them believe in a God, others do not know, and some flat out deny it. But this is information that they all agree is true and accurate. So I want to paint a picture today of not only the enormity of the universe, but just how special this creation is, and paint a picture of what the Creator must be like to accomplish such a thing. Well, I'm going to start really big. We're going to start with galaxies. Psalms 104 and verse 2 says, "Who covers yourself with light as with a garment, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain?" The universe, as we know, is expanding. And the creation of the heavens is described in 9 different verses in the Bible, and every single one of them say the heavens were stretched out. I can think of a dozen words that they could have used, but every single one of them uses that term. Isn't that interesting? Did God actually describe how he created this to the ancients? And some of the things that we're just now finding out? Interesting, huh? Well, there's three types of spiral or galaxies. There's spiral, elliptical, and irregular. And I'm going to talk about these three. In our spiral galaxy, which is where we are, it's sort of like a starfish with bent arms. The spiral arms are where you have an enormous amount of supernova energy and explosions and birth of stars going on. It's so active. It's just an unbelievable place, which makes it a very bright and interesting area. But those areas are not only filled with exploding supernovae, but also huge glass clouds exist in there, and that's the material of which the stars are formed, new stars are formed. At the center of our galaxy is a black hole. And in fact, in the early years of my career, I worked with Bell Labs designing instrumentation to detect it. They wanted to measure certain gamma rays coming out of it. Well, turns out that this is quite common. Most galaxies have a black hole at the very center. The problem is that not only do black holes destroy everything that falls into their gravitational field, but everything that falls in there produces energy, and it produces gamma rays and X-rays and all kinds of radiation. All of this, the center of our galaxy with all of these emissions, is highly deadly to any kind of life. Worse yet, of course, not only do you have supernovae exploding out in the arms, but there's also supernovae exploding in the middle of the galaxy. The galaxy itself is no place for any life forms to exist. It's an incredible place for stars to be born. As far as planet formation goes, one of the problems with the arms of the galaxy is that they have very little heavy element material to build planets out of. They're mostly hydrogen and helium, the gases, big gaseous planets form. But there's no heavy elements because there's the process of star formation out in the arms is pretty slow. It's an older portion, and it's slowing down much more so than the center of the galaxy. And even though in the center of the galaxy there's more heavy metal material, it's so violent that things are constantly exploding and being reborn as stars and whatnot, there's almost no chance whatsoever of a habitable planet existing in our galaxy. It's just too dangerous. Guess where our Earth is? It's in a place called the Galactic Habitable Zone. Astronomers have named the arms of the spiral of our galaxy, and our little solar system just happens to sit right between the Perseus and the, I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere else, but there's two arms, right smack dab in the middle of them. Not in the middle of the arms where there's supernovae exploding, or in the center of the galaxy where there's a black hole. Isn't that quite coincidental? Not only that, but our sun, our star, just so happens to have a circular orbit that keeps it out of those arms. So we don't go falling or floating around into those arms and coming back out and getting zapped with the explosions of supernovae. Another type of galaxy, the elliptical galaxy. It's sort of like an egg-shaped thing, and if you could record a video of it over billions of years and play it on fast forward, it would look like a beehive with bees swarming all over because the stars in it, just they're everywhere. And they all have these massively elliptical orbits, so they're constantly swirling around throughout the entire galaxy, passing next to, hitting other stars, colliding with one another, exploding themselves, forming new stars. Guess what? It's a really, really bad place to put a planet for anybody to live on. There are also, because of the constant formations going on, very low in heavy element materials. So any of the planets that they've been able to find in these elliptical galaxies tend to be gaseous type of planets with massively elliptical orbits again. In fact, astronomers have estimated that our galaxy is in the top 1 or 2% of the most massive and luminous galaxies in the universe. So only 1 or 2% of all the galaxies. And by the way, if you ever go outside and look at the stars at night, sometimes what you're seeing as a star is a galaxy or a globular cluster of stars. And there's hundreds and thousands of those visible to the naked eye. Not a one of them is suitable for life. I'm glad we didn't end up there either. Now, the last one is an irregular galaxy. And you might surmise just by the name that this is a galaxy that's sort of irregularly shaped and is not only irregularly shaped, but changing shape because there's no stable pattern of star movement inside of it. It's constantly ripping itself apart and putting itself together again. It's just a terrible place for any safe havens, if you will, for planets to exist. It's amazing when you think about it. We're not out in the middle of space all by ourselves, which wouldn't work anyway because there's nothing to make a planet out of out there. We're not in the most optimum place for planet formation, which is in the middle of a galaxy. We're not on the spiral arms or in the middle of an elliptical galaxy. That's where all the heavy element material is. That's where they build planets. It's almost like the manufacturing plants down the road, and we're a few blocks away. But our planet exists in a special place. Out of all the billions of galaxies, we happen to be between two very, energetic places, energetic arms of our galaxy, peaceful and quiet. He tells the number of the stars. He calls them all by their names. You know, God has named every single star. You know, I can't even remember the name of my soon-to-be grandkid half the time. I can only imagine what it takes to remember or to name every single star. Galaxies are made up of immense clusters of stars, and they're called globular clusters. And I'm only going to say that once because it's hard for me to say. In 1974, Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, everybody knows Carl Sagan, I assume, but Frank Drake met with Carl Sagan and they talked about beaming a message to outer space to look for intelligent life, because Carl Sagan was highly interested in extraterrestrial life. Well, they got together and they came up with this message, and it's a binary message and it's got all these codings in it and whatnot, and they pointed an antenna at what's called Globular Cluster 13, M13, and it has 250,000 stars in that one cluster alone. They thought that a place like that was certain to have an abundance of life out there. But they forgot to account for a couple of problems. First, globular clusters, I'm working on it. Globular clusters are among the oldest stars in the galaxy and have very little of the heavy elements, carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and all of the metals that we have available for building a place that can support life. Instead, they're mostly composed of hydrogen and helium. Now, hydrogen and helium were formed at the very beginning of the Big Bang. That was the material that was formed. Everything beyond those two elements came from supernovae. Supernovae heat this material up to millions and millions of degrees and produce the heavy elements. Then the supernovae explode. that material reforms into new stars. It cooks it some more, makes more heavy elements, and explodes. And that's the magic of making planets. Well, without the heavy elements, you can't have anything except gaseous planets, primitive gaseous planets, methane and obviously helium and hydrogen materials. But globular clusters cannot produce the heavy metals. So I don't know who they were looking at when they were trying to transmit this message. In fact, there's another problem. They're so densely packed with stars, or at least M13 is, that any planets that did exist are gonna have this egg-shaped orbit, an elliptical orbit. The problem with that is that, if you can imagine, if you're orbiting a star, it's really, really hot for a while, and then it's really, really cold for a while. So you're not going to have, you're going to either have ice or you're going to have steam, nothing in between. Doesn't support life, and life is chemical life. Contrary to all these sci-fi movies, the reality of making a silicon-based life form just doesn't exist. Silicon does not combine with enough other chemical elements to be able to produce life. Carbon is so versatile, so amazing in its bonding capability, that carbon really is the only element that you can conceive of that will form, allow life to form. So without water, you have no life. Sagittarius and Perseus. Those are the names of the two arms where our Earth is settled, not in the middle of a globular cluster. So we've been transmitting our messages to a place where nobody's home. You know, the Lord by wisdom has founded the earth, and by understanding he has established the heavens. That's Proverbs 3:19. For years, speculation has gone on about life, other solar systems that exist that will support life. And it turns out most of the universe is incapable of either producing planets that can support life or providing an environment that can support life. In fact, it wasn't until 1995, and that's not that long ago, that they found the first orbiting planet around the sun. I was astounded because I thought that they had evidence of it long before then, but it's only been, 13 years since they discovered the first orbiting planet around the sun? Visually saw a planet orbiting a sun. Obviously, the speculation existed for a long time. Problem is that it's got an elliptical orbit. You can't support life with an elliptical orbit. It just disappointed the astronomers and scientists to no end. You know, the Earth actually exists in a region called the circumstellar habitable zone. So I guess astronomers like zones. This is the circumstellar, meaning around the star, the habitable zone around the star. And it actually is the band at a distance from the star that allows water to be liquid, to be in a liquid form. Anything too close, it turns to steam, it evaporates. Anything too far away, you have a glacier planet. And even if you had a planet that was too far away, you'd still have to have so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to maintain the heat to keep the water liquid that you'd have no oxygen, so then you still can't support life. So it's a very narrow band. In fact, they've calculated that if our orbit changed by 5%, this planet would die. Everything on it would die. There would be nothing alive. It cannot support life. Something else that's quite unique about the design of this universe is the fact that this planet is one that has a circular orbit. around the sun. In fact, it's so circular. I think it's like 1% that it varies around the sun. Now, if you think about that, and you think about all of the other planets that are out there, why is it circular? Because we all know from basic high school physics that any two objects have mass and pull on one another if they have mass. That's called gravity. So if you've got a planet orbiting the sun and another planet orbiting that one, and it pulls on it this way, and you got another planet that pulls on it, this thing's got a stable orbit. It's actually amazing, isn't it? Part of the reason for that is because most of the other planets have stable circular orbits. That is so rare to find not just one planet with a stable circular orbit, but multiple planets in a single solar system with stable circular orbits. None of them have been found yet. There isn't another one that's been found. We sure won the toss of the coin on that one. Or did we? You know, in fact, if you look at just the single planet Jupiter, which has got a mass 300 times the Earth, that right there, if it was the only planet in the solar system, we would have an elliptical orbit. It's huge, 300 times the size of this Earth. You know, another interesting and wonderful coincidence about the planets is that they have an alternate function besides maintaining the stability of our orbit. In Job, there's some verses that have always fascinated me. It's Job 38, verses 22 and 23. He's, and this is New Living. He says, "Have you visited," this is God speaking, "have you visited the storehouses of the snow or seen the storehouses of the hail? I have reserved them as weapons for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war." This, I've thought about that over the years, and I've always imagined that to be the asteroid belt out there that God is going to use to pummel the earth in the day of trouble when it comes. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. But one of the biggest threats to any planet, much less our planet, is asteroids and comets. And we've got a huge belt of them out there. Well, it turns out that those planets that are around us shield us from most of those. Do you remember the Shoemaker-Levy comet that impacted on Jupiter that they actually got pictures of? That's what Jupiter does. It sucks everything that comes near it into it. And it's a big, huge, gaseous planet, so it's a great buffer for us. Sucks them all in. In fact, Saturn and Neptune also do that with their massive size. And just to give you an example of how dangerous it can be, that belt consists of not only asteroids, what we call asteroids, and dust, but also there are several minor planets that are located in there. I don't know if you know it or not, but Pluto has been relegated to a minor planet. But I think that the solar system actually officially now has two more planets that were discovered in that asteroid belt. So there are some big things out there that can fall into our Earth, and it happens when there's a resonance of Jupiter, and I think it's Neptune. They cause a resonance in the gravity through that field to pull them out of their orbit. Most of the time, they do fall into those planets, though, fortunately. So isn't it amazing that not only do we have planets with the right orbits, at the right distances, with the right mass to keep our orbits circular so we have a nice, warm planet, but that those planets also keep most of the big asteroids and rocks from falling and hitting us because they're out further away than we are. Even with that big asteroid belt. You know, to him that by wisdom made the heavens, for his mercy endures forever. To him that stretched out the earth above the waters, for his mercy endures forever. to him that made great lights, for his mercy endures forever, to the sun to rule by day, for his mercy to endure forever, the moon and stars to rule by night, for his mercy endures forever. I like that scripture in Psalms 136 because it links what God has done to his mercy, to his desire for mankind. Most people, I think, believe that the universe is filled with stars that are very similar to our sun. But actually, our sun is, there's only about, it's in the top 10% of its class. 80% of all the stars you see out there are red dwarfs. And that's a huge number of stars if you think about it. I'm talking about the stars in all three of the types of galaxies. I'm talking about all the stars that we see from this Earth at night in our Milky Way. Most of them are little red dwarfs. The problem with those things is they are small. So it's like having a little pin flashlight and a big emergency light. That little light, that little pin light, doesn't put out much luminosity. And so for a planet to make use of the light, it has to be very close. The problem is that the little red dwarfs, when you get in that close, will cause huge tidal forces on the planet. And unfortunately, if you can imagine filling a balloon with water or a ball, plastic ball, if you roll one that's empty and you roll one with water, the one with water in it does what? It stops. It might roll a couple of times, but it'll stop. Try it sometimes. I know your kids know how to do this. They probably know this scientific fact. They can show you. But if you have tidal forces on a planet, what it does is it causes a mass of ocean water to form on one side of the planet. And just like a ball filled with water, it causes it to stop with the ocean side facing the sun. And that's very bad not to have day and night because you either can't sleep well or you get sunburned. So you don't want to be too close to red dwarfs. So it's impossible to actually use a red dwarf planet to sustain life on a planet. And it gets worse. Red dwarfs also put out solar flares just like ours. Unfortunately, those solar flares are just like ours. And by comparison, a solar flare coming off of a red dwarf, and if you're in closer, is going to look like a miniature nuclear explosion going off by a factor of a million. And so every time you get a little solar flare popping off that planet, you get fried that day, literally. The heat and temperature changes are just dramatic. You can't have solar flares on a red dwarf with a planet nearby because it's just too destructive. I don't know if you've thought about the color of our sun, but our sun primarily puts out blue and red. We've got the higher, shorter wavelength blues and the longer wavelength reds. Now, have you ever asked the question why plants are green? Think about your rainbow. The bottom end is usually red. Top end's usually blue. What's right in the middle? It's the color green. Green happens to be the most efficient color for making photosynthesis. Problem is that red dwarf planets don't put out enough blue to support plants, and more importantly, it doesn't put out any blue to cause the atmospheric ozone to form, which protects you against the sun and its rays, the UV. It also causes water to form. Breaks down water into hydrogen and oxygen, forms oxygen in your atmosphere. That's how we breathe. So it's a really cool color. Blue is great. Green is cool too. But blue is even better at times. The light from our sun is a unique thing in all the universe. Um, I said that this, our sun is in the top 10% of its class. Well, it gets a little more narrow than that, because if you look at other stars that are like our sun, that are in that top 10%, most of them are either hotter or bigger or too blue. If they're bigger, there's a real problem with that, because the bigger stars have an accelerated life cycle, which means they only last a few billion years. Now, I know that doesn't sound like much, but our sun's projected to last about another 10 billion years, and it took about 13, 14, 15 billion years to form. So a really big sun doesn't last long, doesn't allow life to sustain itself on this planet, doesn't allow the heavy elements to form, the atmosphere to form, and all of these things to happen. Another problem with other stars like our own is some of them have too much blue. So if you have too much blue, you get too much radiation from that. It strips off our protective layers. It's more the UV is much more dangerous to life. And the last reason why our sun is not just in the top 10%, but in the top 1%, maybe less, is because it's got a stable light output. In fact, the light from the sun actually only varies about 0.1%. That's 0.1%, 0.001 over the sunspot cycle, which is about 11 years. Think about the size of the sun. Making the light stable to 0.001%, I'm sorry, by a factor of 0.001 or 0.1%, over an 11-year period. That, the ability of our sun to do that is just beyond my imagination. These lights right here don't maintain that level of accuracy. How can our sun, the size that it is, do that? Isn't it amazing? Another interesting thing about our sun, you know, I could go on all day, I guess, but I'll tell you one more. Our sun is also one of the rare stars that has an abundance of heavy elements. And guess where we sit? Out in the middle of nowhere where there aren't any heavy elements. Heavy elements are back in the spiral arms in the center of the galaxy. And yet our sun is just loaded with them. Wonder how they got there. I wrote this down because I couldn't put it all together without it. It's indeed a very rare star that has the right mass, the right light, the right composition, the right distance, the right orbit, the right galaxy, and the right location to support life on any orbiting planet. Did you get that? It's cool stuff. How great is God? And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. How many times do you think about the moon? I mean, really. Whenever you read about the new moons or whatever in the Bible, that's usually about the time that I think about it. Unless I'm trying to look out at the sky at night and it's a full moon. But most people, I don't think, give much of a thought to it. But it's quite underrated, actually. In fact, 1993, they figured something out that was so special about our moon that it just astounded me when I heard about it. If it wasn't for the moon, we could not exist. Moon has basically two very special effects on our planet. The first one is that it stabilizes our tilt. Our planet, relative to the sun, big black sun here, has a tilt. So as we go around, we've got our seasons. Well, that tilt is about 23.5 degrees, and it varies about, get this, 1.5 degrees over 26,000 years. Is that stable enough? That's the reason why it's a smooth ride. Moon does that. But think about it. A moon, to be able to have that kind of an impact on a planet, has to be huge relative to the planet. You will not find another moon that is that size relative to its planet anywhere in this solar system. In fact, you find a lot of planets without moons at all. You know, one of the theories about how the moon formed was, I think there's three or four, but one of my favorites is there was an impact of the Earth with another Mars-like planet, and it knocked a big chunk off of it during the formation of the Earth and the solar system and whatnot, and formed a big moon. Well, if you think about the likelihood, the possibility, the probability of two planets hitting one another, forming a moon that stays around the other one, and the other one skipping off in the middle of nowhere, the fact that they even impacted was, let's just say that the odds are so low of that ever happening, no event like it's ever been, not recorded, but estimated to have happened anywhere else. They haven't found the conditions for it anywhere else. Most of the moons are formed from minor planets and asteroids, which are just broken up rock planets that have just completely crushed themselves, and the remnants have sprung off and been captured by other planets' gravity. So it's extremely rare. I think I jumped way ahead in my notes. The other thing that was, and I did not know this until very recently, the other thing that is so important about our planet is that it produces the ocean tides. And what I didn't understand was that 60% of our tides come from the moon, the other 40% is from the sun, but the tides actually cause a washing of the water on the shores and whatnot that pull nutrients back into the ocean. I never thought about that life cycle before, but if it wasn't for the ocean washing up on the shore and actually rising up and flooding some coastal plain areas and whatnot periodically, a couple times a month, whenever it happens, there would be no life in the sea. There also would not, it would be so salty, no life could live. Because it turns out that as the oceans rise, they filter into the coastal marshes, and the sun evaporates the water, and the salt gets deposited there. So it takes the salt that's being generated by the ocean vents, which they just found out about 10 years ago. Isn't this incredible? It's almost like going back to high school science again. So everything's brand new. Unbelievable. What an incredible cycle that maintains life. And it's done by the moon. Unbelievable. Now, what if the moon was larger? I think you could imagine the fact that we don't want stronger tidal forces, because that gets back to the red dwarf planet problem. If you've got too much gravity, it sucks the water to one side of the planet and causes it to stop. That'd be a bad thing, of course. And if the moon didn't exist at all or was smaller, our planet would most likely, instead of having its axis 23 and a half degrees to our sun, or to its orbital plane, I should say, it would slowly cycle through. You'd have a period of time where it's 6 months of the year, you've got the north hemisphere pointing at the sun, 6 months of the year where the south hemisphere is pointing at the sun. That makes for really long days and nights and really bad growing seasons. It's just right. It's just right. You know, in fact, it's so just right that we can see solar eclipses. Yeah, big deal. Okay, everybody's seen a solar eclipse. Guess what? It's the only place in this solar system, and they, of course, don't have the resolution to find this anywhere else, but it's the only place in the solar system where full solar eclipses happen. Our moon is 400 times smaller than our sun. But guess what? The sun just happens to be 400 times further away. So we are the only planet in this solar system that can see a full solar eclipse. Okay, well, yeah, that's amazing. That's cool, but what does that do for us? Well, you know what? It's part of what's called observability. Turns out that there's so many things that scientists have discovered because of solar eclipses. In fact, they proved that Einstein's theory was correct because of a solar eclipse. They could actually measure light bending due to gravity. You know, we could probably spend hours talking about what's been discovered, but think about this. What would happen if we didn't have any way to tie calendars biblical calendars, for instance, or ancient calendars of ancient people to our calendars? You know how they do that? Solar eclipses. Because ancient peoples recorded full solar eclipses. It was such a rare occurrence that we can actually calculate when every single one of them occur and where they occur. Because they only occur at certain regions of the earth. Is that cool or what? God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. God said he did that for us. He gave us those things. This is cool stuff. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if you have understanding. Who has laid the measures thereof, if you know, or who has stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone? You know, we've looked at, or I've talked about all the galaxies and globular clusters and sun and stars and asteroids and our own sun and the moon. But now I want to talk a little bit about what we live in, our earth. There's nothing like it out there. I love those pictures from satellites, and especially from the moon. And in fact, the Japanese put a satellite out, or a, I don't know what you call it, satellite, call it a satellite, sent a satellite out to the moon, and it is sending back some of the most beautiful pictures of this earth you could ever imagine. I don't care how many times you Photoshop something, it doesn't look nearly as good as that. It is such a beautiful blue and white jewel in space. It's just gorgeous. Well, what is this really a common planet? Do we really think of this Earth as common? Is our place in the universe as common? You know, if we had just a little more mass to our planet, if it was a little bit more massive, had more gravity, do you realize that we would have a planet that's covered with nothing but water for a mile deep? Because a little more gravity would would destroy the mountains, it would flatten everything out, it would smooth everything out. There wouldn't be, and there's so much water in the crust of the earth, we'd be swimming in a mile deep pond. And you know what? That makes it really hard to start a fire, makes it really hard to drive a car, makes it really hard to write a book, makes it really hard to mine minerals, makes it really hard to see the stars. You can't build boats because there's no trees. Even if we were aquatic life forms, there would be no purpose to life because we can't see beyond our own selves, our own little environment. And that's what God gave us in this earth. He gave us a window into the heavens. The other importance of gravity, of course, is holding in our atmosphere. It's protection against radiation, against meteors, against things from the outside world, but holding in our atmosphere is required for us to live. And it just so happens that our special atmosphere, with the right amount of sunlight, right amount of blue color in it, has formed just enough oxygen, about 20%, 18 to 20%, to allow big-brained creatures to live. The bigger the brain of a creature, the more oxygen it takes for that life form to live. And yet, the gravity of this earth, coupled with the wavelengths of light from our sun, has made that possible. It also keeps the interior of the earth from cooling too quickly. I'm sure most of you know that the center of our earth, due to pressure and gravity, is molten. But we have such a finely tuned balance of an insulating atmosphere, the right size with the right gravity, that we can have a molten center, and yet the outer layer, just like cooking something, is allowed to cool enough to form a hard crust. And it's very thin, extremely thin. And that balance has to be so finely tuned, I don't remember the numbers now, but you cannot alter that by more than a few percent before it falls apart. In fact, Mars, they've speculated about a lot of things, but Mars is probably the one planet that everybody's interested in because of its size and the potential for water on it. It's a dead planet. It was not big enough to hold the atmosphere in, to keep the interior from cooling off too much, so the whole thing is nothing but a solid rock. Can't support life. Can't produce life. Here's something that's really cool. Everything is just an interrelated cycle. Carbon dioxide in our atmosphere is actually formed by carbon dioxide venting through volcanoes into our atmosphere. It goes into our atmosphere. The carbon dioxide, along with calcium and some other things, and through processes over time, form limestone. Well, if you don't do something with all this excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it just builds up and up and up because the volcanoes keep spewing it out and out and up. So it forms limestone. But that's not the end of the problem. If you take the carbon dioxide away and form limestone and do nothing with it, you eventually run out of carbon dioxide, which you still need to insulate your planet. Well, earthquakes are the solution. Our tectonic plates, because they float on a liquid center of the Earth, are always crushing together, and one's pushing under, one's pushing up. Everybody knows this. It's a simple geology. All that limestone goes down there, it gets melted again, the carbon dioxide released, goes where? Back to the volcanoes. It's a really cool balancing act, and it cycles, the chemical cycle of that is over thousands of years, but it's maintained the right balance of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere to keep this planet the way it is, warm and toasty for us. You know, I mentioned that the center of the Earth is liquid, and it's because of a bunch of radioactive material that's in there, then the pressure and whatnot. But because of the heat down there and because it's molten, there's actually convection currents. If you boil water, you can actually see the water moving around, and it causes currents to form. Well, that current causes the iron, the molten iron that's in there, to spin around. That makes a big magnet. And that's what forms the Earth's magnetic field. Just so happens that we have the right spin rate. We have enough iron to form a magnetic field around this Earth that protects us from all sorts of nasty particle emissions from the sun and other places. The aurora borealis, those are the lights up in the north that form when you get a solar flare, for instance. A lot of activity going on up there. That's the magnetic field being activated, essentially, by these particles, and it's protecting us. If it wasn't for the magnetic field, we wouldn't have life on this Earth. You know, I could talk about algae that form dimethyl sulfide particles that cause the rain to fall, and when there's too much sun, you get more algae, which form more particles, which causes the rain to cool down and form less algae. You know, the processes that sustain life on this Earth are unbelievable. Unbelievable. If you tried to design a planet and put all these processes in place to keep everybody alive, the people that you're going to create, you would not get past biology 101, chemistry 101, geology 101. It's amazing what has to go on in order for us to be able to live on this Earth. You know, we've got the fact that we're located between the spiral arms of the galaxy, the right intensity and size of the sun, the distance from the sun, the protective outer planets, the massive moon combined with the Earth's mass, the circular orbit, the tilt, the gravity, the liquid core, the heavy elements, large oceans, the oxygen-rich atmosphere. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing. And we've been given a window from this very little planet to see all of this. This window that allows us to see out onto the universe. We're not stuck in the middle of a galaxy where there's so many stars around us, we can't see beyond our own little galaxy. We're stuck in between two arms that not only protect us from nasty things, but let us see other galaxies, other stars. We're in a planet that has an atmosphere that's not so dense that we can't see beyond it. We can use telescopes. We have the means of looking through our atmosphere, but it's a good compromise because we need that atmosphere, so there's a little bit of distortion, but astronomers get around it. We're also in a place where we can see our sun. with solar eclipses. We can see so many things from this Earth, and we can analyze, and we can list all of these technical things, these life cycles, these interactions, these miraculous events and occurrences that keep us on this Earth, breathing, studying the heavens, thinking about God. You know that even the polar ice caps, there's such a balance in temperature that we live in mostly a world with liquid water, frozen from time to time, but the polar ice caps have existed for such a long period of time that scientists use that for a record of all sorts of things, carbon dioxide, methane. They can even determine sunspot cycles, variations in magnetic fields. It's astounding. That's a scientific tool that God gave us, a window onto what's going on around us. Do you know that earthquakes, they've actually mapped the interior of the Earth to some extent, three-dimensionally, because of earthquakes? Is that cool? You know, on this Earth, we not only have enough oxygen to have a big brain, relatively speaking, I think, but we can burn fire. We can dig and find metal and develop technology. We can study things. We can write it down. We can do all of these things. You couldn't do that if it was a water world or if it was frozen. Think about it. If we were stuck in the middle of a galaxy, what's there to learn beyond our galaxy? Is there something beyond our galaxy? We wouldn't know how big God is if we couldn't see how big the universe is. He's given us such an incredible, wonderful, intricate place to live. And too many things have to happen and are in such perfect balance. You can't deny a creator. You can't deny that kind of wisdom. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visited him? For you have made him a little lower than angels and have crowned him with glory and honor. God has crowned us with glory and honor. He's given us wondrous things. Things that nowhere else exist in this universe. You know, David knew this earth was not mediocre. He knew the heavens were not mediocre. He knew that man was not mediocre. The Copernican principle, it's a lie. This earth is incredibly wonderful and unique. The heavens proclaim, said David, the glory of God. The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. His craftsmanship. His expertise in building things. His wisdom in making them work and making them function. Day after day they continue to speak. Night after night they make him, that is God, known. They speak without word or sound. Their voice is never heard. Yet their message has gone throughout the earth and their words to all the world. God has made a home in the heavens for the sun. Psalms 19. That is truer than we could ever imagine. You know, sometimes I think that Dave wrote most of his psalms just because he kept trying over and over and over again to express what and who God is. And he could never do it, so he kept writing and writing and writing. And every time he'd put down different words and add to it and take away from it and say it a different way, and he never could quite get there. Because God is so big. God is so much more than we could ever imagine. And the universe is just a speck of his spirit that he put out there. And he said, I'm going to create something beautiful and wonderful, and I'm going to put a people on that creation. You know, if we can't find words for the universe, if we can't describe the infinity of it, the beauty of it, the intricacy of it, the glory of it, how are we ever going to find words to describe our Creator? And how are we ever going to find the words to truly appreciate how infinite His mercy and His love is toward His creation, the crowning of His creation, the crowning glory of His creation, mankind? That's you, and that's me, that's us, brethren, and that's soon to be the world. It's amazing.